All right, so this is Bio 231.
Bio 231, 231, 231, once, twice, there we go. And it is Wednesday, November 24th, which means tomorrow, take it easy on your rugae, right? Don't overstretch them. All right, so today we are going to cover the digestive system. Oh, and there it is, chapter number 23, digestive system. All right, which means then that we have 4 lectures left. All right, so we've got 2 next week, 2 week after, and then December 6th is a lecture, but not on the 8th. December 8th is finals. So finals start in the middle of the week, that's why there's no lecture. And then you have your exam number 5 on the 13th. Right, which is a week from that December 6th date. So you got a lot of time to study for that last test. Okay, sign-in sheet I think is going around someplace, right? So you signed in already. And so we're going to move to digestive system. So first, the components of the digestive system. But you know what? Maybe I'll just stop and ask. Anybody have any questions over the schedule or anything like that? No? Everything's pretty good. Next week, the lab practicum starts, I think, on Wednesday, but not Monday. Monday is still just a regular lab. Okay. All right, so digestive system. Starting with the oral cavity, which has teeth, right, and the mandible can crush food up against the teeth and the maxilla. And then you have some salivary glands that add saliva to the food that you're eating. Saliva acts mostly as a lubrication or a lubricant so that when you swallow something, moving it down from the oral cavity through the esophagus into the stomach right here, it slides down very nicely. But there are also some digestive enzymes that work to digest starches, and starch is made from sugar. So sugars like glucose is the basic building block of starch, which is in bread and pasta and things like that. So flour basically is a sugar. And remember from lab, you got 3 kinds of salivary glands, parotid, sublingual, and submandibular gland. Make sure you can find those on the mannequins that we have up in lab. And so then food goes into the stomach. We're going to talk about the functions of these different structures. All right, so here is the stomach, and then the stomach empties into the small intestine. The small intestine's got 3 divisions, the duodenum, jejunum, and then the distal segment is the ileum. I can't tell which is which, except that the proximal division is going to be attached to the stomach, and so that proximal division we would call the duodenum. Okay, and then the distal segment is going to attach to the cecum here on the large intestine, and that distal segment is the ileum, and everything else that's in between, that's the jejunum. So that's the only way that you can tell the difference between duodenum, jejunum, and ileum. Otherwise, you'd need a microscope and look at the histology, the walls of the intestines. All right, then food that you're digesting or digested food moves into the large intestine that we have right here. It's got a totally different function than the small intestine, and then it's eliminated from the body via the rectum and anal canal right here. There are valves along the way, circular smooth muscles that regulate the flow of material from one segment to the other. We call those sphincters. Right, so we have sphincters like anal sphincter, pyloric sphincter, ileocecal sphincter over here. We'll talk about those things. And then some more accessory structures, sort of like the salivary glands right here. The liver functions as part of the digestive system, and the gallbladder, and the pancreas right here. Spleen really is not part of the digestive system, but it's included on this picture just for fun. Okay, so those are the components of the digestive system. And like many things in anatomy, we are very interested in what? Layers of the of various kinds of systems. So you got to become familiar with layers of the digestive tract. And this is really important because this is how we stage disease that's happening inside the alimentary canal. And what are some diseases? Well, there could be ulcers, there could be erosions of the intestines due to stomach acid or maybe infection, and also tumors form within different layers. And many thousands of people die of colorectal cancer every year. And that's kind of a sad situation because there's really not many people that have to die of that particular disease process because it's a slow-growing tumor and it can be diagnosed very early. And with a lot of forms of cancer, if it's caught early, guess what? It's 100% curable, right? So we'll maybe talk about that a little bit. So we do want to know the layers of the alimentary canal because that's how you stage these disease processes. And you have to stage a disease. It has to be diagnosed and staged before you know how you're going to treat it, right? So layers are very, very important. So let's look at some layers. So let me just scoot this up like so. The outermost layer, which is number 4 down over here, that's the serosa. All right, so here is the serosa. It's mostly connective tissue. There's another layer with loose areolar connective tissue in it, but it helps form the visceral peritoneum, which is the membrane that surrounds all of the organs in the abdominal and pelvic cavity, and it helps suspend the intestines in place, right? And it's also very slippery because there's serous fluid over it, because these intestines are what? They're moving around all the time, right? Moving food through the tract, and we're going to look at a couple different ways that muscles contract to help move food around in the alimentary canal. So that leads us to the next deeper layer, and these are responsible for motility. This is the muscularis externa. And there's, in most parts of the alimentary canal, there are two main layers. There are longitudinal layers, which is most superficial, that goes along the long axis of the tube, and then there are circular smooth muscles that just kind of encircle the alimentary canal. And coordinating contraction of all these smooth muscles right here is the myenteric nerve plexus. And there are more nerves in the myenteric nerve plexus, which we find in your digestive tract, than there are in your spinal cord, which is, what, a major part of your central nervous system. And as a matter of fact, for years and years and years, people actually thought that since there were so many nerves in your digestive tract, that really was your brain. That really was your central nervous system. That's where you appreciated reality, all right? A little humorous right now, but back then, all right, that was obvious to people that were doing dissections, which didn't prove to be true. But it's still an extensive network of nerves that control the and coordinate muscle contraction in the muscularis externa. All right, so that's two layers, serosa, muscularis externa. The next layer is the submucosa, right here. The submucosa, you can see, is highly vascular. There are a lot of blood vessels. There are glands in the submucosa that secrete things into the lumen of the intestinal tract. And there's also adipose tissue in there. And there can also be lymphatic tissue that helps fight infection, because this tube, the lumen of this tube, is really what? Outside of your body, right? So that lymphatic tissue is important to prevent microorganisms that are in the lumen of your digestive tract, making sure they don't get inside your body, right? Move through the wall of the intestinal tract. And there are also certain bacteria that are inside the digestive tract that are beneficial, and they will metabolize some food particles that you eat and will make vitamins. And vitamins are biological compounds that you cannot synthesize. They're essential nutrients that you need to live a healthy life, but your body cannot synthesize it itself, but it relies on the bacterial action inside the digestive tract to make those vitamins for you, which then you absorb and maintains a healthy state for you. So that is the submucosa. The next deepest layer is the mucosa. And that's got a couple layers. We see another layer of longitudinal smooth muscle. We call this the muscularis mucosa. All right, so as opposed to the muscularis externa over here, there's a myenteric plexus as well that regulates the contraction of these smooth muscles in the muscularis mucosa. And then another layer within the mucosa right here is what we call the lamina propria. It is also highly vascular, and it contains glands that secrete things into the lumen. And then the last layer right here is the epithelium. And in most places of the gastrointestinal tract, The kind of epithelium that we have right here is just a simple cuboidal epithelium, and it also has a brush border, microvilli. Microvilli are important for absorption. It increases the surface area of this particular epithelium for absorption. All right, so those are the three main layers of the digestive tract: serosa, muscularis externa, submucosa, and then the mucosa. But be sure you can break it down into some other various components. All right, and I'll mention some of the other components as we look at different parts of the intestinal tract as well. All right, so we're done with layers right here, which then let's talk about the function of the muscularis layers. All right, so it has to do with motility of the gastrointestinal tract. There are two kinds of motility that occur in the gastrointestinal tract. One of these things is called peristalsis. Peristalsis is just the propulsion of a bolus of food from the mouth all the way down in one direction down to the anus. And it's going to be processed, right? It's going to be digested, and that digested material, some of it will be absorbed. So you can see this bolus of food being pushed in just the antegrade direction through the gastrointestinal tract. There's another kind of motility, and it doesn't move that bolus of food in one direction, but sometimes it moves it forward, sometimes it moves it backwards, sometimes it chops it into little pieces and mixes it with a different compartment of food, and we call that segmentation. So segmentation is a mixing of food that you eat with, for instance, maybe gastric juice and intestinal juice, which mixes all that food that you eat up together, and that aids in digestion. So segmentation, you can see, for instance, if here you have a bolus of food, right, some smooth muscles now are going to contract in this mid-segment here and this mid-segment over here. This circular smooth muscle is going to relax, so it's going to mix half of this compartment with half of this compartment. All right, and then eventually what happens, it just homogenizes this whole mixture right here into just a uniform consistency. So it's a mixing function and not just a movement function that's due to peristalsis. So those are the two kinds of motions through the alimentary canal. Okay, so we talked about the oral cavity a little bit. That's just to break big food particles down into smaller food particles, and you have some initial digestion of starch into glucose. But how efficient a mechanism is that? How long do you chew your food for? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? Half hour? Or what? No, it's like seconds, right? And as a matter of fact, maybe you even have some dogs at home, and it's not even a second, right? It's like they almost inhale. So that function is not terribly important in us and many other animals, because as soon as that digestive enzyme that breaks starch down into glucose, we call amylase, once it reaches the stomach, it becomes inactivated because of the very acid pH of the stomach. So that action is no longer very important for us. All right, then the function of the esophagus is just to move food from the oral cavity down into the stomach. And once it's in the stomach, okay, the stomach performs some very important functions. And the two most important are storing and mixing. So when you eat food, all right, it doesn't move directly into the small intestine, but it stays in the stomach for a period of time. All right, and for mixing of food, what kind of motility is involved with mixing? Or what are the two kinds of movement, motility in the intestines? Peristalsis and segmentation. Which one is the most important in the stomach? It is segmentation, right? So it's churning up the food that you eat with gastric juice and mixes everything together. Gastric juice is made from of enzyme we call pepsin. Pepsin can do some initial digestion of proteins. And there are probably four main compounds of food that we eat. One is a protein, which a building block is amino acid. The second one would be starches or sugars, and the basic building block would be simple sugars or monosaccharides like glucose. All right, another basic food group would be lipids, would be fats. And fats are kind of in a group all by themselves. They're different than sugars and amino acids, for instance, because if you put sugar in a glass of water, what's going to happen to it? It's going to dissolve right in. But if you put some butter or fat in a glass of water, what's going to happen to it? It's just going to sit there. It's not going to dissolve, right? So lipids are quite a bit different than most of these other compounds that we're talking about. Doesn't like to dissolve in water. And then the fourth thing would be nucleic acids, right, that make up your chromosome. So those are the four basic kinds of groups. What we're really going to be looking at will be proteins, sugars, and lipids. Nucleic acids are really a pretty small component of those four basic biological compounds. And pepsin right here is responsible for the initial digestion of proteins, which is one class of those biological compounds that we talked about. Proteins are pretty stable. It's hard to digest them, and you need some pretty severe conditions in order to begin digestion, and that's why the stomach also secretes hydrochloric acid. So the pH of your stomach is highly acidic. The pH is about 1 or 2, and the only more acidic you can be is 0, right? The pH scale goes from 14 to 0, so if you're at pH 1, you can't get much more acidic than that. It's highly acidic, which aids in digestion of proteins. All right, the stomach also secretes intrinsic factor. An intrinsic factor is a biological compound that's necessary to absorb vitamin B12. Vitamin B12 you can't make in your body. You need to have that in your diet. And that's really an important kind of vitamin because that's necessary for mitosis. What's mitosis good for? For growth, right, and proliferation of tissues to replace old and damaged cells. And can you think of one place in your body where you're losing a lot of cells all the time? Like blood, exactly what I was thinking of. Red blood cells only last about 120 days and they have to be replaced. As a matter of fact, you replace about 2.5 to maybe 3 million red blood cells every second because that's how fast they die, and you need vitamin B12 to replace all those cells that are dying. So if you don't have vitamin B12, guess what condition you have? You have anemia. That's what shows up pretty early on because red blood cells don't last very long. Okay. And the storing and mixing and secretion of gastric juice, right, produces chyme, right? And that chyme is just a mixture of food and gastric juice. So that's where food sits, right? It sits in the stomach. Some initial digestion takes place because really the work, where most of the work for digestion and absorption take place is the small intestine. And the small intestine has to have time in order for it to do its job. And you can eat a lot faster than the small intestine can do its job. So if you eat and eat and eat, like we all can, the small intestine can't do its job, so guess what the stomach does? It holds all that material until the small intestine is ready and available to process it, right? So the stomach really is a holding area for all the things that we eat. Okay? All right, so there are goblet cells that secrete mucus. Maybe I'll see if I can find a nice picture of these things. Over here, goblet cells, you know, secrete mucus. So we're going to be looking for something like a small intestine, like a stomach. Okay, here's a pretty nice picture of a stomach right here. I think this is a quiz that most of you have taken. All right, here's the entry into the stomach from the esophagus. There's a little pinching of this material right here. There's some smooth muscle, so some people consider this to be a sphincter so that the acid contents of the stomach don't reflux back up into the esophagus, but sometimes it does in some people, right? And that's just called gastroesophageal reflux disease or GERD, and that acid can actually cause ulcers in the esophagus. Some people have to sleep kind of sitting up if this sphincter is a little weak. Right, because otherwise they might regurgitate even a lot of food, right, when they're sleeping up into their mouth, and if you're breathing, then it goes into your lungs, and it's just kind of very irritating when you're trying to sleep. Okay, this area right here called the fundus, this traps a lot of gas, right, so mostly there's just gas in this area up over here, then in the body of the stomach right here, this is where chyme is being mixed together, and you can see that the muscularis externa in the stomach, because segmentation is such an important function of the stomach, there are actually three layers, right? There's not just two layers of the muscularis externa, but there are three layers right here. And the other modification that you see right here in the stomach is that the mucosa is highly convoluted. And usually we have folds when we want to increase the surface area of something for absorption, but the main function of the stomach is not absorption, it's for holding stuff, it's for storing food that we've eaten until the small intestine is ready to do its job. So these folds right here are there so that the stomach can expand, right? So that the mucosal lining can actually expand without ripping. And as a matter of fact, these rugae can expand to such a large degree, too bad I can't flip back really fast, all right, this picture right here, the stomach can expand so much that it can actually stretch almost all the way down to the urinary bladder. And I am looking at numerous people right now who will do that when?
Tomorrow.
Okay, maybe not now after I mention that, okay. Try to be on the end of 5,000 calories of consumption and not 10,000 calories, right? Okay. Come on, oh, that's right, it's Thanksgiving, who cares, right? Okay, so that's the job of that stomach, right? It stretches and stretches. I don't think I've ever known anybody to perforate their stomach by overeating, but don't try it, okay? When it gets really uncomfortable, then just stop. All right, so that's the job of the rugae within the stomach. Where is that stomach at? Here it is once again. Okay, so I think y'all memorized these different parts. Now, the pyloric sphincter is a true-to-life sphincter that is very strong. The environment of the stomach right here is very acidic, but the environment in the small intestine is going to be the opposite. It's highly alkaline, so pH goes from about 1, and it switches, goes all the way past neutrality, which is 7, and goes up to like pH 8 or even 9, which again is a fairly radical environment, but that's necessary for the final digestion of proteins and other compounds that are in our diet. So things have to be regulated pretty severely before stomach contents get mixed or put into the small intestine. That's the job of the pyloric sphincter or pyloric valve right here. Okay. So let's look at maybe some structures, microscopic structures of the stomach. Oh, this is a pretty good slide. All right, so we just have a nice cross-section of the wall of the stomach. It's not very deep. This is just the mucosa, and I can see the epithelium right here, and in this epithelium, I would expect to see some goblet cells. I don't see any, but the stomach is loaded with goblet cells which secrete its product right onto the surface of the stomach. What is it? What does a goblet cell secrete? Mucus, that's right. So mucus you're aware of is pretty slippery, right? Like when you have a cold, that's that slippery stuff coming out of your nose. But in the stomach, it's really important. Not only does it allow things to slip over the surface of the stomach, but mucus is a really tough compound. It's very hard to digest, so that when it coats the stomach, it prevents the stomach lining itself from being digested. So it's a nice protective coat. So that's a really important job of those goblet cells right there. All right, so there are some other cells right in here. Here is a deep invagination of the epithelium, and these are what we call pits, which empty into the stomach. And the cells of this area right here produce digestive enzymes and hydrochloric acid. So this is a glandular tissue. So a pit is really a gland secreting those compounds that make their way into the lumen of the stomach. Okay, so what are these things? All right, so let's look at this slide over here. Okay, the chief cells secrete pepsinogen. Oh, and I want to talk about pepsinogen. I highlighted it right here. Pepsinogen is important for nomenclature purposes. Whenever you have a word, or most of the times when you have a word with a certain kind of suffix on it, like ogen, see that little ogen right there on pepsinogen? That means that these chief cells, how do I get back over here? These chief cells right here secrete a pepsinogen into the gastric pit that then makes its way into the stomach. And that ogen that we see on this word over here means that it's an inactive compound. So pepsin can what? Digest proteins. It's for the initial digestion of proteins. And it's a good thing that it's secreted in an inactive form, because what could it do to these cells right here if it was synthesized in an active form? It could just auto-digest the cells that produce it, like these gastric pits. So it's produced in an inactive form, and once it gets into the lumen of the stomach right here, it interacts with hydrochloric acid, which converts it into pepsin. So pepsinogen is the precursor to pepsin, but it's what? In a very safe, inactive form. All right, so the chief cells secrete pepsinogen. All right, and another enzyme called lipase. Guess what the substrate for the enzyme lipase is? It breaks down lipids, right? That's just some more nomenclature for you. And lipids are just basically fats. So it breaks down fats. Okay, the other kind of cell are the parietal cells. We find these in gastric pits as well. And they're responsible for secreting hydrochloric acid. And these are the cells that in some people become overactive, secrete too much acid, which then can produce ulcers or indigestion. And these are the cells that are worked on by antacids that you take. Okay, some people have a pretty big problem with that, but you can even control those pretty well with over-the-counter medication. All right, so every day, these cells secrete about 1.5 liters of gastric juice. Gets placed into your stomach, and I think you produce about 500 mLs of saliva every day. So if you were to spit into a container instead of swallowing, what's that? Is that about 500 mLs right there? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's 500 mLs. That's how much saliva you produce every day, and you would need 3 of those to put all the gastric juice that your body secretes into the intestinal lumen. So what were to happen if you were to lose that much water every day? Is it important? Is water balance important for you? Can you dehydrate? Absolutely. So if you're secreting all of that fluid into your digestive tract, that is water that you're losing from your body, because the lumen is really what? Outside of your body. So that's just something to consider as we talk about these things. Okay. Well, the stomach is a pretty rough environment. Even though it's protected by mucus, the lifespan of these cells is still pretty short, and this gastric epithelium is renewed about every week, right? 3 to 6 days. It's a high turnover rate, right? So that's even faster than a red blood cell. So these cells even need vitamin B12 to reproduce. So a lot of times when somebody is given chemotherapy to inactivate highly metabolic tissues, like for instance a tumor, that's why it affects the gastrointestinal tract and produces nausea, because these cells are affected by those chemotherapeutic agents as well. You lose the lining of your digestive tract with some chemotherapies. So that's just what we call a side effect, right? Unfortunately. And as chemotherapy gets better and better and better, then, right, we find drugs that have a lesser and lesser effect on the epithelium of your digestive tract and a more powerful effect on tumor cells. All right, but that takes time to find all of those different kinds of compounds. All right, so that is the stomach. All right, so what did we say about the function of the stomach? 2 important things: storage and mixing. Now, what is your concept of the digestive tract? It would be, the function would be, for the digestive tract, it would be digestion, okay, as well as what? Absorbing those nutrients. And so did we say digestion and absorption for the stomach at all?
No.
So it's not really involved in that. That's why its structure is so radically different compared to other parts of the gastrointestinal tract, right? Because it's not for really digestion and absorption. All right, so that takes us to the next segment, and that is the small intestine. All right, so the function of the small intestine is digestion and absorption. All right, there are intestinal glands that secrete about almost 2 liters of intestinal juice into the small intestine. So now what are we up to already? So let's just say 2 liters, 1.5, it's 3.5, another from saliva. So that's 4 liters of fluid that you're losing from your body just in the process of digesting food and absorbing nutrients.
All right, the divisions. You have three divisions. The duodenum, which is attached to the stomach. The ileum, which attaches to the large intestine. That's the distal segment. And the jejunum, which is the middle segment. So let's take a look at some interesting features of the small intestine. Okay. So here is a pretty good picture of the small intestine. Again, you can see the serosa and what the muscularis externa right here, and then the submucosa, and then even the mucosa over here with lamina propria in here and the epithelium. And now, what can you tell me about this particular tube right here? Does it look smooth on the inside and flat, or what do you see? What is that word that we use? And I've never really heard it applied to the small intestine, but it's a really good word. What do you call all these different folds? Like convolutions, right? So the small intestine is convoluted. It has all these folds. So these things right here that wrap around in a transverse way around the small intestine, we call these circular folds, or plicae circularis, which just means a circular fold. All right, so this is just a way to take a tube, a really long tube, and do what? Shrink it up from end to end. Because what is one of the most important functions of the small intestine? Oops. Is what? Absorption. And what do you need for absorption? What do you need for exchange? You need a surface area or a doorway, right? Doorway for exchange. And so that's just a way of making the surface area a lot bigger. Because you could stretch out the small intestine without really stretching any material, right, just by flattening out all of these different plicae, all these circular folds. All right, but now in the small intestine, you have some other things. You have all of these little finger projections coming off the circular folds, and we call those villi. And what's the function of these villi? They are what? They're still convolutions. They're just at a smaller scale, but there's many thousands more of them than there are circular folds. So that also means that you could take the intestine and not only just flatten out all of the circular folds, but you could keep pulling without stretching and then flatten out all of the villi, which does what? Also increases the surface area for what important function? Absorption. Yeah, absorption, right? Because that increases the surface area. So that is the second modification that enhances absorption in the small intestine. The first are these circular folds. The second are these little villi right here. And I might have to go to the next slide. So here we see the villi. You can see the lamina propria up inside this villus right here. Okay. And then let's look at these columnar cells. And now I can see nice goblet cells right here, which secrete mucus that protect the epithelium from autodigestion. But if we just look at one or two cells in this region right here, here's that nice columnar cell, and you can refresh your memory what all these different organelles are and what they're doing. But one important organelle is this surface right here, this apical surface. It's not flat, right? These are not cilia. These are microvilli. They're a little bit smaller than cilia, but they're not important for motility because cilia sweep and beat and things like that. These folds are, again, like convolutions that do what? Increase the surface area of the cell. So this, the width of this cell in terms of absorption is not from here to here, but is what? If you were to stretch this cell out on the top, now it is, what, two or three or four times as wide as it really is that we see down here by the basal region of the cell. So that also increases the surface area. So we have those three important modifications in the small intestine for absorption that increase surface area. What were they? The macroscopic one that you can see with your naked eye are the circular folds. Things that you can almost see with your naked eye gives the lining of the small intestine kind of a velvety, very soft appearance, but you can't quite see them. Those would be the villi. And then the things for sure that you can't see are these microvilli right here. So you got circular folds, the villi, and microvilli increase the surface area for absorption. All right? Well, what is that increase, really? All right? So as a matter of fact, when somebody says surface area, what should you be thinking of in everyday language? Doorway, right? Like this door here was 2 square meters, exactly. Okay? So you got the plicae circularis, that just means circular fold. Circularis means what? circular, and guess what plique means? Fold. Like pleats or something like that, all right, in some language. Somebody probably knows what that is. All right, so if we just take out a small intestine from somebody without stretching it at all, being very gentle with it, lay, you know, cut it open, lay it flat on a table or something, and measure the surface area, it would be about 3.5 square feet. That's not very much, right? If this were a simple straight tube, that's what the surface area is. But because of the plicae circularis and the villi and microvilli, if you flatten all those things out, the surface area increases to 2,200 square feet. That's what? That's almost 1,000 times more. It increases the surface area almost 1,000 times, and that aids in absorption. So the doorway is what? Huge to get inside your body via the small intestine. So 2,200 square feet is about 47 feet by 47 feet, or 240 square meters. But in real life, what does that mean? That's the floor area of an average two-level house. All right, so that's pretty cool. And it's all folded up in there doing its job, and that is pretty nice. So capillaries. In this villus right here, here you see capillaries in the lamina propria. These are responsible for absorbing amino acids, which are the building blocks for proteins, simple sugars, which is the building block for starches. But now lipids are not absorbed by capillaries. They're absorbed by this structure in the very center of a villus. That's what we call a lacteal. And a lacteal is a lymph capillary. So this is what's responsible for absorbing lipids, and that goes into the lymphatic system. And those lipids are processed, all right, before they're dumped into the circulatory system. Because remember, they don't like to be in water. We'll find out how they dissolve themselves in water a little bit in just a little while when we talk about some accessory structures. All right, so some other things that we find in the small intestines are Brunner's glands. That's in the submucosa. They're really just in the first proximal division of the small intestine. And these glands secrete very basic kind of solution. All right, so if you take an acid and a base, like an acid from the stomach, and you put a base in it, what happens to the acid? Yeah, it helps neutralize it, right? So these Brunner glands are important for helping neutralize the acidic secretions that come from the stomach. The crypts of Lieberkühn also just are known as intestinal glands or intestinal crypts. All right, so for instance, on this slide on the right, here is what, an intestinal crypt. And here you can see the orifice of the crypt right here. And these crypts contain goblet cells. They secrete mucus. Right, and some hormones that help regulate the movement of material through the small intestine, and digestive enzymes as well for sugars, compound sugars, and proteins. All right, and some of these signals go back to the Brunner's gland to say, for instance, oh, the environment is a little acid, you should start secreting some alkaline material to help neutralize those acids that are coming from the stomach. Right, and cholecystokinin from those crypts, that's a hormone, signals the gallbladder to release bile. All right, and it also signals the pancreas to release digestive enzymes. So digestive enzymes come from the submucosa of the intestinal tract, but also the pancreas. You probably saw the pancreas in lab. And so the pancreas aids in digestion as well. Okay, so we see this villus is important for what? Absorption, because of surface area. So the overall function of the small intestine is a lot different than the stomach, right? It's for digestion and absorption of nutrients, like amino acids, simple sugars, and lipids. All right, so that takes us to the large intestine. I'm going to skip over some of these things. Should I skip over this now? Since I mentioned a pancreas, okay, where's that pancreas located at? Underneath the stomach. All right, so let me close this slide. Let's go back to, all right, so here is the pancreas right here, and there are ducts within the pancreas that carry precursors to digestive enzymes into the small intestine right here. because again, those digestive enzymes should not be active inside the pancreas, because what would happen to the pancreas? It would be digested, right? It would digest itself. Well, we don't want that, so those enzymes are inactive until they get into the small intestine, and there they become activated. Okay. So the pancreas secretes trypsin and chymotrypsin for protein digestion, right? It secretes pancreatic amylase, which is kind of a cousin enzyme to salivary amylase, and remember that was for digesting starches, and then pancreatic lipase, which is for digesting lipids. Yeah, that can break lipids down into its basic building blocks. And so remember that glandular tissue can have two different forms. It can be an exocrine gland or an endocrine gland. What's the big difference between exocrine and endocrine? I think I went over this in this class. Exocrine, yeah, we did when we talked about glands. An exocrine gland makes a product and secretes it, and it goes into a duct. And a duct carries it to where it's going to have its action. So, for instance, these digestive enzymes are secreted into the pancreatic duct, which then carries it to the small intestine. That's the exocrine part of the pancreas. But the pancreas is also an important endocrine gland. It has an endocrine function. It secretes insulin and glucagon. These are hormones. They don't go into a duct. They get picked up directly by a capillary someplace in the pancreas, and then they circulate through your whole body via the circulatory system. All right, and so that's the definition of an endocrine gland. It secretes its product not into a duct, but into the interstitial space, and then that product is absorbed by a capillary and delivered everywhere in the body. Okay, and the pancreas has a head and a tail. It's got that pancreatic duct and sphincter. And let's see what kind of pictures you have for that. Yeah, even in lab, you don't have to know some of this stuff. Okay, so here's the pancreas, here's the tail, body, and the head. Here's the main pancreatic duct, and it joins with the common bile duct, and it empties into the small intestine, into the, what's the proximal division of the small intestine? That's the duodenum, right? And then there's a little papillae. What's a papillae mean? It's a projection that kind of looks like your fingertip. Remember papillary muscle in the heart? Right, so there's a little projection, a little papilla or nipple or something. You might want to consider that right there. Okay, and then there's a sphincter, the hepatopancreatic swelling, which is called an ampule, and sphincter, which controls the flow of material from the liver as well as the pancreas into the small intestine. There's even an accessory pancreatic duct right here. Okay, so that's pretty good for the pancreas. All right, which now takes us, so the pancreas is an accessory structure to digestion. It's not really part of the elementary canal, but it's an accessory structure. Now that takes us to the large intestine. All right, and from lab, you're kind of familiar with the large intestine. And what does that large intestine look like? Does it look like the stomach? Does it look like small intestine? So take a wild guess. What is the function going to be? It's going to be different because the structure is a lot different. Okay, so the function of the large intestine or large bowel is not digestion. No digestion should be taking place there, or very little. Okay, and if there is digestion taking place there, we'll see what happens. All right, but absorption is its most important function. Water and salt. So salt is what makes electrolytes in our body, like sodium and potassium and calcium, for instance, are electrolytes and chloride ions. We need these ions for normal function of muscles and nervous tissue. As a matter of fact, all cells need these ions. So we don't want to lose them in feces. They should be resorbed. Right? So the large intestine absorbs a lot of materials, especially water. Now, why is water important? Because how much water has your body already dumped into the intestinal tract? Half a liter of saliva, right? 1.5 of gastric juice, liters of gastric juice. What, 2 liters of intestinal juice. So what's that? 4 or 5 liters of water that you're losing just in the process of digestion. And if you weren't to resorb that water, then you would dehydrate very quickly as a result. So the job of this large intestine right here is to resorb all that water and put it back into the blood so that you don't become dehydrated. Now, in the small intestine, there are also billions of bacteria. And they can be harmful bacteria, but in most circumstances, these are beneficial bacteria that produce vitamins, including vitamin K. Vitamin K is necessary to produce certain clotting factors in people. So without the proper bacterial microbiota in the large intestine, you might have a clotting disorder, which means that if you give yourself maybe even a paper cut, you could hemorrhage as a result. It just won't stop bleeding, right? So that's very important. All right, so there is right here a sphincter that controls entry of material from the small intestine. What's the last segment, the distal segment of the small intestine called? That's the ileum. All right, so the ileum empties its contents into this proximal division of the large intestine that we call the cecum. And here is another very strong and important sphincter called the ileocecal sphincter or ileocecal valve. And a sphincter is just a circular, smooth muscle. What did we call a circular skeletal muscle? This is a blast from the past. Maybe not so much a blast as it is from the past. It's what? Orbicularis. Right, like orbicularis oculi, orbicularis oris. Well, a circular smooth muscle is a sphincter. And so it takes time for the small intestine to do its job. And so this ileocecal valve is closed until food is processed by the small intestine. Because if the small intestine doesn't do its job and it puts nutrients into the large intestine right here by accident, guess what's going to happen? Who's waiting in the large intestine to take all those nutrients and just go crazy, have a big party? All those bacteria will now say thank you for all that glucose, for all those amino acids and lipids, and they're going to proliferate. So instead of having billions, right, you're going to have billions of billions of bacteria in the large intestine, all running around, irritating the bowel, making it very motile. All right, increasing peristalsis of the large intestine. They also produce a lot of gas when that happens. And since the large intestine now becomes very active and that material transits through the large intestine very rapidly, guess what the intestine doesn't have time to do? Absorb water. And so that all comes out. What do we call that stuff coming out very quickly? That's very watery. That's diarrhea, right? So when somebody has, we call that malabsorption syndrome. So anytime the small intestine is not doing its job and food gets into the large intestine, that's malabsorption syndrome that always results in what, copious amounts of watery stool as a result. Okay, that can also be produced by an infection of the large intestine here as well. So sometimes that happens to people. So as we get older, all of us lose the ability to produce an enzyme that breaks down a sugar that's in milk. It's a sugar specifically in milk called lactose. Okay, so lactose is the sugar. So infants have plenty of lactose because that's what they nurse on, right? That's what they build their bodies with. And as that enzyme is no longer produced in a person and they drink milk or have any kind of dairy product like ice cream or something, then that lactose goes through the small intestine without being digested, so it isn't absorbed, and where does it go? Into the large intestine, and who is there thanking you for all that lactose? All those bacteria, and it produces malabsorption syndrome as a result. So a lot of times you might be on some kind of medication. One of the side effects will be diarrhea, and what does that mean? That means that that medication is now inhibiting absorption of some kind of nutrient from your small intestine. It could be a sugar or a protein. It ends up in the large intestine right here and produces malabsorption syndrome. Some people voluntarily volunteer for malabsorption syndrome. And you might ask yourself, why would somebody volunteer or actually take drugs that promote that kind of situation specifically for that reason? Well, some people might want to control their weight, okay, and they can take a medication that will block absorption of lipid from what part of the intestine absorbs things again? Small intestine. They can take a pharmaceutical agent that blocks absorption of lipid from the small intestine, and then if it's not absorbed by the small intestine, where does it go? Large intestine. Now who's there thanking you? Those billions of bacteria, right, which then irritate the large bowel, producing copious amounts of watery stool, all right? But not just that, what is the compound that they're trying to metabolize? Lipid. It's going to be oily water, watery stool as a result. And as a matter of fact, the large intestine gets so irritated, those people don't even know that they are stooling themselves, right? Because it's so watery and lipidy, right? It just comes right out. So what do you have to do? Well, you have to wear a diaper, okay? Does anybody know the name of that medication? It's called Ally, all right? It was marketed by a different name at a higher concentration before, about 5 years ago, but it was such a bad medication that nobody would take it after a while, okay? So it's kind of an interesting therapy because lipids contain so much energy. When you have a high-fat diet, that is the time when you have a tendency to gain a lot of weight, right? Because there's just so much energy content in lipids. So the rationale is sound, but the side effect is what? Well, you can't really live with that side effect, right? It's just too severe. Okay. It produces a nasty malabsorption syndrome is the best way to talk about it. Okay. All right, so you can see that the different parts of the large intestine, you got the ascending, right, and then the hepatic flexure, the splenic flexure over here. These are the bends in the large intestine corresponding to the side of the body that has the spleen and the liver. The tenia coli is kind of like a ligament that runs up and down the length of the small intestine that smooth muscles attach to. These haustra right here are just convolutions that aid in water and salt absorption. And as chyme is being dehydrated, right, as water is being resorbed from it and salts are being resorbed from it, what is being produced is feces, right? So the function of the large intestine is to produce feces, but what is that really? That is just absorbing water and salt from chyme as it's moving through the large intestine. All right, and then we got a little segment right here that's called the sigmoid colon, and then it empties into the rectum. The rectum, right, has some sphincters. There's an external and an internal anal sphincter right here. One is smooth muscle, one is skeletal muscle, all right, which controls evacuation of the large bowel. The smooth muscle you can't control, and then feces bumps up against the voluntary sphincter, giving you an urgency, right, for a bowel movement, and then you voluntarily control the skeletal smooth muscle. And that's probably an important thing to recognize in yourself. A lot of people become constipated because they don't recognize that urgency and respond to it, right? They might work all day long or maybe for 2 days with and ignoring that, and so then you train your large bowel to become impacted with feces, and that becomes a real problem for people. Right, when they lose that ability to have a bowel movement, then they take all kinds of other agents that try to counteract that. Okay, so it's important to listen to your body in a number of different ways. That's just another different way. Okay, in the large intestine, we're thinking about different layers, right? This is one of the regions that is prone to cancer, right? Large bowel cancer, and it can be screened very easily with an endoscope, right? Just moving up through the rectum, there are two different ways. There's a short endoscope, which we call a sigmoidoscopy, just looks at the first initial segment of the large intestine. And then there's an endoscope that goes all the way up to the left colic flexure right here. And that's probably the better procedure that you should have because the preparation for that procedure is exactly the same. And so the procedure is not very onerous. It's not very difficult, it's not very time consuming, but the worst part of that process is the day before because you have to prep yourself. In order for a physician to look around or a technologist to look around for polyps or cancer, guess what? The large intestine has to be very, very clean. And so that large intestine has to be cleaned out, and it depends on the physician. Sometimes they give you an enema, a solution that's an enema that cleans out the large intestine right here. Other physicians wish for you to drink a gallon of a solution called Go Lightly, all right? And that's just a very nasty name for that particular gallon of fluid because there's nothing Go Lightly about it. You're going to go very heavily, okay? And the reason why they call it Lightly is because it's a solution that has electrolytes in it. So if you were to lose that much fluid in your body, you'd have a severe dehydration and electrolyte imbalance. So it's actually it's a pharmaceutical grade solution that you have to drink so that you don't become depleted of water and electrolytes. All right, so the important thing is to have a nice clear view of everything that's happening in here. So when a physician tells you to prepare yourself for sigmoidoscopy, right, do exactly what they say. Because if you don't do exactly what they say you drink 3/4 of that gallon instead of the whole gallon, right? And you're not particularly clean and then you go get the exam, guess what you have to do? You got to reschedule, which means what? Well, if you add both up together, now you got to drink a gallon plus the 3/4 of a gallon that you tried the first time, so you have to repeat. So the best thing to do is just not have to repeat the exam, right? Just do exactly as they say. That's the only tough part about that exam. But what's really nice is that it's what? It's something that could save your life because colon cancer certainly is deadly if it's not treated. And it's what? 100% curable if it's caught early. And large bowel cancer is a slow-growing cancer in most people. So you have years and years and years to find it, but that's not a reason to put off a colonoscopy, especially if you have family history, okay? Or if you have a high-fat diet, for instance. Okay, so that's something about the large intestine. So let's review some parts of the alimentary canal. Okay, which one is important for absorption and digestion?
Small intestine.
Which one is for storage and mixing? Stomach. Which one is for absorbing salt and water?
Large intestine.
Yeah, so that's pretty good. Now, if you're going to think about the job of the intestinal tract, I kind of think of an appliance that you have at your house. Or maybe you actually have to go outside your house but just say everybody has one of these things in your house, okay? What kind of appliance? Let's name some appliances that you might have in your house that you use weekly. What do you have?
Washing machine.
Washing machine. Oh, that's pretty good. What else you got? Like a toaster and an oven. What else? Dishwasher. Okay, of all those appliances that we mentioned, which could be thought of as like your intestinal tract? Washing machine and dishwasher. Because what does a washing machine do? Adds a bunch of water, churns things up, makes things dissolve, maybe breaks things down when you add detergents to it. Okay, and then what happens? All the water is removed once again, right? Because you want to wear your clothes again without them being dripping wet. So think of your digestive tract as being like a washing machine. It's washing all the food that you're eating, breaking it down, right, and then extracting that material, right? The only difference is that in the washing machine, the stuff that comes out of it is the stuff you really like, and all the dirt goes down the drain, okay, which is a little bit opposite compared to the digestive system. Okay. What about some other accessory structures, like the liver? Okay, the liver has an important digestive function. It makes bile, and bile neutralizes acids from the stomach. So bile is emptied into the proximal division of the small intestine, namely the duodenum. It joins, right, with the pancreatic duct, so it can neutralize stomach acids. But another important function is that it contains bile salts, which act as detergents. Right, and what does a detergent do for you at home? Yeah, it cleans things. But what kinds of materials? Like, for instance, if I have, something that's sweet, okay, and I spill it on my clothes, and it's not particularly oily, what can I do to clean my clothes off? I can just use water, okay? But say, like this morning, I was making some toast, and I put some butter on it, and it slipped out of my hand. And how does that toast always fall, it seems? Butter side down, right on your pants, okay? So now, can you just take some water and clean that butter off your pants?
No,
because fat, butter, and water just don't mix. So in your body, that has to be solved. And the way that it's solved is with bile. It has bile salts. It acts as a detergent or an emulsifier. So it can take big globs of lipid and break them down into small little globs for digestion. And so then they're digested and absorbed, right, when they're combined with bile salts from bile that's produced by the liver right there. All right. Now, what part of the small intestine absorbs those digested lipids? There's a special part. It's a special part of a villus. It's the very center single capillary. Okay. It's called the lacteal. So digested fats get absorbed by lacteals, but amino acids and sugars that are digested are absorbed by the blood capillaries, two different parts of the vasculature. One is lymphatic system and the other is just a blood vessel. All right, so you do have to know the architecture of the tubes coming from the liver. And I think this is the only liver slide that we have right here. All right, so here we have liver. All right, and you can see this is where the gallbladder is tucked up underneath the inferior surface of the liver. So the liver is producing bile, and then it's secreted into these ducts. So what function of the liver is that? Is that an exocrine function or an endocrine function? That's an exocrine function, since it's going in a duct. All right, so here is the right hepatic duct. Here is the left hepatic duct over here. These join together to form the common hepatic duct. All right, and if you're in a fed state, that bile is going to go down the common bile duct into the small intestine. But if you're in a fasted state, that material doesn't go into the small intestine. No reason to go there. So it takes a little side trip through the cystic duct into the gallbladder until such time that you have a meal. Right, and then cholecystokinin from the small intestine is going to cause contraction of the smooth muscle of the gallbladder, and that's going to squeeze stuff down through the common bile duct into the small intestine to aid in digestion of lipids. Okay, so some people can have problems with the gallbladder because gallstones can form, certain compounds can precipitate out of bile and form little rocks in here or stones, which then can block these passageways. And that's really obnoxious and it hurts really bad because it causes constriction of these smooth muscles. They go into spasm. And whenever a muscle goes into spasm, how does that feel? Well, it hurts like hell, right? So you feel really miserable when that happens. So what else does the liver do? It can store various compounds for us. Glycogen is really starch. It's animal starch. What did we say what the building block of starch was? It's sugar, simple sugars like glucose. So glycogen is a storage form of glucose in your body. All right, the liver can store some vitamins like A, B12, D, E, and K. It can store some elements for us like copper and iron that we need in certain parts of our body. And the liver also makes some clotting factors for us and other kinds of enzymes that we need to have in our blood. And it's an important metabolic organ because it can interconvert some kinds of foods into others. Like it can help convert sugars into amino acids and amino acids into sugars. So it's an important metabolic organ for helping balance metabolism inside of our body. And it can help detoxify certain kinds of proteins by producing ammonia, converting ammonia to urea, which then the kidneys get rid of. And guess what? We got to talk about the kidneys, I think, next time. All right, and is that it? That's it for lecture. So please sign the sign-in sheet and be kind to your rugae tomorrow. Where's that sign-in sheet at? Who's got the sign-in sheet? Oh, good, it's right here. If you need the sign-in sheet, it's coming down here. Yeah. Yeah.
Hepatic photo system.
Yeah.
The capillary brings like new